Tomorrow. I'm Rod Hill, FM News.
Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
That, of course, is Donald Trump, the next president of the United States, although we've got to wait all the way to January to finally get that good news. But guess what? Donald Trump set off a firestorm this past weekend. The left was going absolutely bananas about the fact that he used the words elected and bloodbath in the same sentence. So, what did they do? They decided to manipulate that soundbite and simply say, why, he's saying he's threatening America. He is threatening election violence if he doesn't get what he wants. Well, it's actually what a majority of Americans want. We want somebody other than Joe Biden, the senile old man who now occupies the White House. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And yeah, we are broadcasting live all this week from the Hoover Institution on the Stanford campus. Think of it this way. Stanford, as a university, is, of course, a very, very liberal institution. On the other hand, right in the middle of that liberal sea of Stanford, there is a tiny little red island, and that is the conservative institution that was originally founded and named after one of America's presidents, Herbert Hoover. So, we are here because we get a chance to talk to some very smart people, including people like, say, Victor Davis Hanson and Thomas Sowell and people like that. It's one of the advantages of being able to come down and broadcast the show for a week. So I hope you stick with us all week. But let me get back to what Trump had to say, because I can't tell you just how much reaction there has been to Donald Trump saying it's going to be a bloodbath if I don't get reelected. Well, it's probably true. But you know what he was talking about? He was talking about the auto industry. Now, I would tell you that part of me suspects that Donald Trump knows exactly how to tweak the media so that they will then twist the truth and then get caught in their own deception. If you want to be Shakespearean about it, since we're on a college campus, they get hoisted by their own petard, which means blown up by their own bomb. And that seems to be happening right now. First, welcome to the program. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day, whether we're broadcasting from our home studios or whether we're broadcasting from some remote location around this great country. 866-HEY-LARS is the number. And if you're a naysayer, you're going to go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can always vote in our X poll, used to be called the Twitter poll, now it's the X. You can find the brand new question from the news of the day at Lars Larson Show on X. We put the same question up at LarsLarson.com. But there's part of me that thinks that Donald Trump is so very, very clever that what he does, and I don't have a problem with him doing it, he says, I'm going to go out and I'm going to throw some red meat out there for the liberal press. Although maybe red meat is the wrong metaphor for the liberal press. Maybe a bunch of arugula. I'm going to throw a big wad of arugula out there because I know that the liberal press corps is going to chomp down on it. Case in point. When he told this very big audience, because that's the only kind of audience that Donald Trump draws, is a very big audience. Have you seen some of his rallies? He gets tens of thousands of people. Joe Biden would have a tough time filling a phone booth at most of his events, and he's not going to have very many of them. He's apparently going to run, instead of running from the basement of his house in Delaware, he's going to run from the basement of the White House again and see how that works out. Might be a one-time-only trick, Joe. Might not work the second time. But when he says there's going to be a bloodbath if I'm not elected, of course, America's reliably liberal news media, they ran with it. even though they knew exactly what it was. Now, I have to give credit to one young lady that I heard on MSNBC when the news anchor said, I can't believe he's saying there's going to be a bloodbath. And, of course, she wanted it to suggest that there was going to be some kind of violence. You know, like think Antifa riots, but Republican style. Only Antifa and BLM riots are not Republican style. That is left-wingers only. But she ran with it, and this young lady reporter said very meekly, well, I do have to say he said it in the context of automobiles. And you say, how does bloodbath relate to automobiles? Well, I'm going to explain. So the liberal news media, they run with this thing. They think, we've got him now. We're going to tell America he's threatening election violence. Like the violence that happened in 2020. You mean the violence put up by BLM and Antifa, the left wing? Yeah, they do that stuff all the time. Destroy cities, do literally billions of dollars of damage. Anybody who bothered to listen to more than just a soundbite and a very selectively edited soundbite from the speech had heard what Donald Trump was talking about. He told the crowd that China is building car factories in Mexico, and they're planning to swamp the United States of America and its consumers with cheap Chinese battery cars and devastate America's auto industry. Now, we already know that Joe Biden's plans for battery cars are guaranteeing 60% layoffs for the United Auto Workers. And Trump said that is not what we're going to let happen in Mexico. Listen to this.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it. Went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border.
Yeah, then Trump told the crowd that if China even tries to do that, he will slap a 100% tariff on their cars, but that only happens if he's elected. And then he allowed to the crowd, he says, otherwise, if he doesn't get elected, if he can't stop China's plans, aided and abetted by Joe Biden and the Biden crime family, which has made millions of dollars in its sleazy deals with China, well, if Biden gets back in, it will be a bloodbath. Listen to Trump's plans for a tariff.
Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Yeah, you know that honest journalists, and I consider myself an honest journalist, my staff, my producers, and their great producers, Donovan and McKenzie and Joel, they all know we will not edit sound out of context. We will not make it sound like somebody is saying something they did not say. The liberal news media, they do things a different way. Honest journalists know you can't take sound bites out of context. But it's an election year. Liberals have stuck themselves with a senile candidate who's losing the polls, can't complete a sentence, can't even walk across a room without help. So they look for any port in a storm. And if it means lying to your audience for a political cause, well, that's what they do. Glad to be with you live from the campus of Stanford at the Hoover Institution. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours, it's Sanitized Entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sick.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
It's absolutely the truth that most people can't afford one of those shiny new battery-powered cars. But now, the state of Oregon plans to help out those who can already afford them by gifting them thousands of dollars of your tax money. Now, that might sound crazy. So the people who can't afford the car are not going to get the money, but the people who already can afford the car are going to get tax money from people who can't afford the car? You're absolutely right. That's how crazy it is. You see, Oregon has this ridiculous electric vehicle rebate program, and strangely enough, they say it's run out of cash. They said it was really popular when they began to give away money for nothing at all. Yeah, imagine that. Talk to an economist and ask how much demand you might have if you offer to give away somebody else's money and the people getting the money don't have to do anything to get it. Most of it was given away to folks with fat bank accounts as an incentive to buy Teslas and cars like that. So Oregon's found another pot of money. Coincidentally, they found it during an election year to give out more gifts to some of the most well-heeled people in the state. Out of 4.5 million people in the state, this gift from we the taxpayers will go to only about 1,000 people. And they have to be ready to move quickly as they have to buy the battery-powered car between April 3rd and June to get $7,500 back from DEQ. Now, most of us know DEQ as that agency that forces you to put your gasoline-powered car through unnecessary and ridiculous clean air stations. I think of them more as a clean-out-your-pocket station, rip-offs from the state that doesn't want to surplus all the people who work at the GEQ check stations because they have to pay their salaries and they don't want to lay them off. So mostly rich people will be able to get the battery rebates, and average folks will pay the bill. That's how it works. Frankly, if the marketplace actually worked the way it's supposed to, those battery buggies would be a bargain. They're piling up unsold on dealer lots, even as major car companies like Ford have announced dramatic scaling back of production. And why? Because EVs ain't selling. You should be able to pick them up for a song, but what kind of consumer product is so unpopular you actually have to pay people to buy it? Kind of like that kid who was so ugly his family had to tie a pork chop around his neck to get the family dog to play with him. Kind of like that. Our question of the day. I saw this story in which the state of Oregon is now going out and enforcing water requirements, and it's hurting a lot of small farmers, you know, people who buy vegetables. In fact, there was a story, I believe it was in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, about Christina Del Campo, who used well water to grow her vegetables at Oak Song Farm near Eugene. Well, now the state says you can't grow those vegetables without a water rights permit. I got to tell you something. How is it that the state of Oregon is so enthusiastic about pot? They literally grew too much in the last several years, so much so that the pot growers can't get rid of it to the pot retailers. So in other words, everybody loses money. But growing pot, that takes a lot of water. Somehow, we've got all the water we need for things like Facebook server farms and marijuana plantations and illegal aliens and all that. And we don't have enough water for farms that actually grow the things we eat. Somebody explain that one to me. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to every single agency of government. In this case, I'll mention the city of Portland. I'll also mention the Washington legislature. Any government that passes a phony new clean climate tax and then says, oh, we accidentally brought in too much tax money, what are we going to do? Should we give the tax money back to the people who paid it because we over-collected it? Or do we have other plans for that money? Two specific examples. The city of Portland passed what they called the Portland Clean Energy Fund, the PCEF. It's a tax on corporations, which means consumers end up paying the tax. They were expecting it to bring in $40 million a year. Instead, it's bringing in about five times that much, about $200 million every single year. That means that they are getting so much money, well, they could actually lower the tax, or they could give it back to the companies that paid the taxes. They're not going to do that. They want to give money to things like Oregon nonprofits or green energy projects and job training. And they're also talking about using it for general government purposes. And if you think Oregon's the only place where that's happening, in Washington, you had the Jay Inslee carbon tax, and it overcollected as well. So what are they going to do with it? They're figuring out other things they can spend the money on. Of course they are. Why would they give it back to the people who paid it? That's why they get this week's grill. They're literally talking about taking monies that they collected under false pretenses and simply spending it on more government. And by the way, in most cases, when you create more government, you create new programs and all that, and you hire the people to staff those programs, that's not just more government. It's a future obligation, which you will owe for decades, whether the money is there or not. Today's best email, but you can always send more, comes in from Phil, who says, Lars, I've been so frustrated with the monopoly that the fake news seems to have on this country. A lot of my clients are older people. The only news they get is CBS or NBC. A lot of them recite Democrat talking points, and they look at me in bewilderment when I try to explain to them what's really going on. I've told them about my appreciation of talk radio, convinced a few of them to try your show. I've explained that they'd be introduced to new conservative ideas they'd never heard before, but explained in a very thoughtful and calm manner. I could have suggested a host of other shows, figured you'd be the best one to hopefully convert a new convert from the Democrat lies to the truth. I hope that doesn't put too much pressure on you. I'm just trying like crazy to get people in my universe to hear the truth. With your appreciation, your listener, Phil. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And today's poll on X, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I get emails all the time from people saying, whatever happened to that Greater Idaho idea? You know, the one where a bunch of Oregon counties, mostly eastern Oregon counties, some in central Oregon, have said, we don't want to be a part of Oregon's crazy anymore. We'd rather join Idaho. Well, guess what? Idaho lawmakers in the House of Representatives voted 41-28 in favor of passing a bill in support of the Greater Idaho movement. Now, does that solve the whole problem? No, not at all. It's a long process. But consider this. The state of Idaho is moving forward with it. Oregon counties have been moving forward with it and having votes. 11 counties in Oregon have signed a petition in support of the expansion. This would also have to be signed off on by Oregon lawmakers in Salem, who I don't think give a damn about eastern Oregon anyway, and then sent to the federal government. The Congress would decide ultimately whether or not parts of Oregon, whole counties, would be allowed to join the state of Idaho. It's a Monday. We're live at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and you're listening to The Lars Larsen Show.
The Lars Larsen Show. Because you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarsen.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show, live from the Stanford campus at the Hoover Institution this week, but still talking about issues in the Pacific Northwest. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, now about a quarter of a century of serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Now, if you ask how many cities in the Northwest have a problem, a major problem with the homeless, meaning drug addicted for the most part, sometimes alcohol addicted people living on the streets and often making their way in ways that are not legal at all, taking drugs, theft, other kinds of problems like that. Well, consider all that and then consider what's happening in one little microcosm of that. I got this email from Kim Hector, who joins me now. Mr. Hector, thanks very much for coming on the show to talk about what's happening in Grants Pass. What is it the Grants Pass City Council is going to be voting on, and why are you concerned about it?
Well, the city of Grants Pass wants to put an 87-space Janser RV park on 6.83 acres right next to my neighborhood. which is a good neighborhood, and they plan on, although they won't admit it, taking all the homeless camper vehicles and putting them in that park, which is directly across the street from a school. It's about three blocks away from me and my home. And these lawless people that are drug addicts, sex offenders, and convicted felons are most probably going to be occupying that park. And it's directly across the street from an elementary school. It'll make a huge problem with traffic and increase the crime tremendously. And I don't know if you've been to Grants Pass lately, but we have, one of the worst homeless problems you've ever seen. Well, you notice we have a sign downtown that says it's the climate. Well, they should change it to it's the homeless, because they care more about dealing with the homeless and their problems than they do with the lawlessness that's been created by the homeless people in our city.
I tend to agree with you. Let me ask you this. You know for sure that this is not a commercial RV park aimed at travelers and visitors and that sort of thing, but this is aimed at people who probably won't even have to pay to use this space. Am I right?
Well, we have a pretty liberal city council here, and I would bet money that that's exactly what they plan on doing. That's the rumor, and I'm pretty sure it's accurate.
I mean, if they're voting on this, that means you say it's already been passed the Grants Pass Urban Planning Commission?
Correct, and the city council is going to be annexing the property, and then the next step after the city council approves the annexation of that property of the 6.3 acres, they're going to go ahead and put this RV park in there. And we have a problem with homeless camper vehicles all over our city. And so I guess in the city council's wisdom, they thought, gee, let's put it over in a nice area town, and those people probably, you know, won't complain much.
Except that that you're going to set them straight on that. I mean, I have no problem with that. If they were proposing a commercial RV park, they'd probably have to propose it as just that, a commercial recreational vehicle park. And it always strikes me as strange when a city decides we're going to allow an RV park for homeless that would never have been allowed as a commercial business. Do you happen to know what that property was originally zoned to be in your city?
I really don't know exactly what it was zoned to be, but I can assure you that problem is tremendous with the homeless camper vehicles, and I know this city council, they're probably most probably going to do that, because tourist season is coming up and they don't want people coming into town seeing these homeless camper vehicles all over town. So they want to shove them in a location right by where I live. And I'll tell you, Grants Pass is not a safe city to live in. Anywhere you go in this city, you could be in jeopardy from these homeless people that are convicted felons and sex offenders and drug addicts, and you don't know what they're liable to do.
No, and to put it that close, I mean, after all, the elementary school in question, as I understand, is Parkside Elementary School. So people bring their kids to a school that's adjacent to a park. Sounds ideal as a place for a school. Sounds absolutely awful as a place for people who are, you know, addicted to drugs. They may be using theft or other kinds of crime to fund their addiction and to pay their way. And it makes me wonder you're just saying the Grants Pass City Council is that liberal that they would choose to do this?
Oh, I'm sure of it. There's no doubt in my mind.
Have you had any trouble getting a bunch of names on a petition to be able to go to the city council and say don't approve?
Well, what I'm trying to do is get people in the surrounding neighborhood to go down to the city council meeting Wednesday night at 6 o'clock and voice their concerns about this RV park.
Yeah, because I think that makes sense as well. And you really do need to nail down whether or not it's a commercial RV park. Because, you know, obviously, people who are addicted to drugs are not going to go pay 30, 40, 50 bucks a day or, you know, per night to put their RVs there. I mean, if they had that kind of resources, they'd probably have a regular place to live, right?
Lars, I can assure you, they'll tell you, oh, no, we're not going to put homeless people there. And the next thing you know, it's in there, and they've got homeless campers all over the place. What are you going to do then?
Yeah, and what is the solution? Because I've got my own ideas for solutions for solving the homeless problem, and they're not crazy and they're not draconian. They're actually just saying make people follow the rules the way every other homeowner and every other citizen has to do it. How would you solve Grants Pass's problem?
Well, tell me, how do you deal with lawless people that steal from the stores, that attack the police, attack the citizens? How do you deal with those types of people?
Enforce the law. When you attack somebody,
right,
you go to jail. You end up in front of a judge. The judge has penalties, and he may tell you, you have to change your life this way. I mean, this is what has been told to criminals for a long, long time. They may say, you can choose so many months in jail, or you can be let out early if you'll agree to amend your life. Get a job, pay your bills, get off drugs, get off alcohol, you know, stay out of trouble. You get in trouble again, you get go back and do the time that I would have put you in jail for originally. That's how our society, and I think that's a reasonable way to tell people you have to follow the rules. Well, what if I don't? Well, if you don't, you're going to sit in a jail cell. Most people don't want to sit in a jail cell. And you say, okay, we'll let you out early. You've got to go to drug treatment. You drop out of drug treatment, it's a parole violation, you're back in jail. You know, you can use those tools that have been there. And frankly, the government never hesitates to use those tools against you and me. So if they're saying, well, there's a class of people that because of their circumstances, the rules don't apply to them, I think every other citizen is entitled to say, well, hold on, which rules do I get to ignore? You know, can I speed on the highway? Go ahead.
I was going to say, in our town, it's catch and release. The police are overwhelmed because there's so many of them, and the police try and do a good job here, but it's too overwhelming for them. All our emergency services are tied up, like the hospital and fire, dealing with these drug addicts that OD on the street. So while the law-abiding citizen's having a heart attack and he calls 911, they go, I'm sorry, we don't have anybody available.
And that shouldn't be the case, because it turns drug addicts into first-class citizens. And we've done the same thing with illegals. They have become superior citizens in that they have the right to do things that you and I can't do. The minute you go to that kind of system, the rest of the people in the system might just say that I'm not paying my property taxes. Kim Hector, thanks very much. And I hope a lot of people show up and give the city council a piece of their mind. Back in a moment, we'll get your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me get some of those calls first, and then I want to talk about another crazy thing that you're not going to believe. Let's start out with Elsie. Elsie, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning, Lars. Yeah, I have a question. Like, I'm 72 years old, and I remember way back, I'm not sure when it started or where it ended in the 80s, I used to be able to write off those interest rates on the credit cards.
Yep.
And get a refund. And I remember we used to be so excited come April, we had this extra money so we can buy or do things. And now with my savings is what, not even bearing ass what the interest rates on that is, but I'm paying 29% interest. How can we get that back?
How did you lose it? How you lost it is they changed the tax code, and they said you can deduct the interest you pay on your home mortgage. What you can't deduct is the interest you pay, say, on a car loan, appliance loan, or credit card loans. That was a change made by the Congress on federal federal taxes, and Oregon, for the most part, for income taxes, because Washington State has no income tax. In Oregon, Oregon's tax code generally mirrors whatever the federal tax code says. There are some interesting exceptions to that, but for the most part, whatever the federal tax code says, Oregon decides to follow suit. And they said, we're not going to pay. And if you think of it this way, Elsie, whether you believe in the government incentivizing people to do things or not, you know, like if you have kids, you get a tax deduction, right? So you're encouraging yeah. people to have kids because we generally think having kids is a good thing, right? If you buy a house, they think that generally buying a house is a good thing because it gives you a commitment to the community. It means you're really concerned. Whereas if you live in a lousy neighborhood and rent in a rental unit, you can say, well, if the neighborhood goes bad, I'll just move somewhere else. So owning a house means you've got a skin in the game. So the government incentivizes people to do some things, doesn't on other things. If you want to change back, you're going to have to talk to the U.S. Congress and say, I want to be able to deduct the interest on my cards. But frankly, how much interest do you think you pay in a year? Do you know? Not percentage terms, but dollars.
Dollars. Well, just one, like I'm 72 and I had to live all these credit cards. One was almost $2,000.
No, that's how much you owed on it, right?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
What are my balance, you mean? My balance, my
credit. Well, yeah, what your balance is. So if you owe $2,000 and the interest rate is 25% in a year,
no.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I paid $2,000. I mean, my balance on my one card is $17,000, and I paid over almost $2,200 in interest.
Which means that on your Oregon taxes, if it were deductible, you'd save $200. On your federal tax, you'd save about, the average American pays about 14% on their total income. You'd save 14% of $2,000. You'd save $280. That's about it. You're talking about a few hundred dollars. Now, I understand when you're living on a fixed income, a few hundred dollars matters, but that they took that away a long, long time ago, and it would only come back if the Congress says, let's make interest deductible. And one of the things that might make you queasy about that, Elsie, if somebody, you know, if I said to a member of Congress, should we make interest on credit cards deductible? Do you know what that makes more attractive? Debt. It makes, meaning being in debt is more attractive because the government will help pay some of the cost of borrowing all that money. Every time the government says, Elsie, if you'll do this, we'll give you some money, they're telling you ought to do more of that, whatever that is. In this case,
yeah.
When you borrow money and they pay part of the cost of the interest, they're saying there's an incentive to borrow more money. Having no interest write-off for it is an incentive to pay it off. And so I think it would be a tough one to convince either conservatives or liberals, let's encourage Americans to take on more debt. Americans owe an amazing amount in debt right now. I'd encourage people to pay their debt off. Let's go to Guy in Albany. Hey, Guy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Hey, what was on my mind was about Grants Pass. And
yeah.
I spent a lot of time down in Grants Pass through the many years. I've actually been a manager on the show when we're down there for our Boatnik days.
Yeah.
And I'm also an Eagle member down there. And I can't believe what's going on with this homeless stuff and these people that are trying to say, we've got to do something. Well, the problem is when you keep doing something for these people, they keep flooding up. And
yeah.
They're flooding up from a lot of places, and it's like, no, you need to put the hammer down and just say, we don't accept this, we do not believe in this, and if you want to work for something, good. Get out there. There's plenty of work to be done. But if
you
don't,
I agree with you, Guy.
Get on your high horse and get the hell out of here.
If you put this in personal terms, if you and your wife, God forbid, your son or daughter says, hey, I need a place to stay for a while, I've been kicked out of my apartment or whatever, and they come and sleep on your couch for a while, and you want them to eventually move back out on their own, You don't go build another bedroom onto the house saying, now that you've decided to come home, says sleeping on the couch, we're going to make a special place for you to go. Not if you want them to move out. You do not say, we're going to make it more comfortable for you to stay. You say, we're going to make it less comfortable. And I think you are right on the right track, Guy. Thanks for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to talk about the exoneration business. And if you say, Lars, exoneration, is that a business? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, exoneration can be a business. These days, it's practically an entire industry because you almost don't go a day or two without seeing some major news organization somewhere in America that says, well, so-and-so was locked up for a decade for horrible crimes, but now has been exonerated. Well, if you want to test the truth or falsity of that, I'd suggest you talk to my friend, former District Attorney Josh Marquis, who joins us now. Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm fine. This is a very real problem that affects a lot of taxpayers more than they realize.
Okay, and you'd actually talked to a reporter about something that had happened in Chicago, Illinois, and you described to them how there are folks, not just in Chicago, but there are folks all over America who are arguing they've pushed a meme that says a great many people, perhaps thousands or tens of thousands of people, are falsely convicted of some of the most heinous crimes, sent away to prison on sentences that may be life or maybe decades in prison, and then at some point they're released and they're described as exonerated. Do very many of them actually turn out to be literally not guilty of what they're accused of, or is this something else?
No, it is. It's a gross abuse of the English language that it's more than just an abuse, because it turns into tens, even hundreds of millions of dollars. Here's the way our system works. When someone is accused of a crime, any crime, but particularly a serious one, it's the government's duty to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. If we, prosecutors, do not prove it, the person walks out of the courtroom as innocent and unconvicted as they walked in. And they're to deny that there haven't been injustices would be silly. Of course there are. The question is, what level are they, and what about these many of these huge settlements that are going out when, in fact, when you look at the cases, it appears that, yes, they did shoot the other guy, and the exoneration may be that one of the defense attorneys at one of the appellate levels forgot literally, you know, to dot an I or cross a T. And the way our system works is if the state cannot check all the checks and balances throughout, that person may walk. But that's not the same thing as exonerated. And the mainstream media has taken this as which first was a cliche and has turned it, as you say, into an industry. And, you know, I mean, let's take a case that many people know of, George Floyd. Okay. And there's some considerable controversy, even though the officer who is responsible apparently for his death has been convicted and is serving, you know, functionally a life sentence.
And by the way, Josh is a longtime Democrat. I just want to say that and then listen to what he's saying with that in mind.
Sure. And so George Floyd was awarded $29 million. Now, you can say, okay, well, it was terrible what the cops did to Floyd. I can assume that, you accept the verdict. This was a not an intentional murder, but a reckless murder. Every other kinds of case, you judge, you know, how old was the person? What was their earning potential? Let me be real. I'm an attorney. I'm 71 years old. If I were to be beaten to death by the government this evening and my wife wanted to sue, My guess is the most that she could ever get would be about $3 million. And the point is that, you know, I just don't have that much value left in me. I'm not worth $20 million.
I mean, it sounds kind of cold to describe a human life by value. But if you say, here's a bright young
man
or
woman,
you know, who's just graduating from college, why, they have 50 years of potential ahead of them, and they might make, you know, tens, or well, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars every year. They have a lot of potential. Somebody who's your age or my age, yeah, not so much. George Floyd was a long-time drug addict. He was a long-time criminal. His legitimate earning potential was likely pretty close to zero.
Zero.
His cost to society was gigantic. And I'm not saying then it's nothing, but in this case, they tried to get him in that car. He blew a gasket when they tried to put him in the car. So it wasn't as though they just found this man and said, hey, let's kill this guy. They worked on him for a while to try to get him in custody in a car and take him off to the jail where he would have had some medical treatment as well. And he might well have still overdosed because it appears he had on board a quantity of drugs that might have killed a lot of people. Apparently it didn't kill
him. Fentanyl or methamphetamine.
Yeah, fentanyl and methamphetamine.
But we have to look at what the prosecution was not the elected district attorney of Minneapolis. It was a guy named Keith Ellison, who was a congressman from Minnesota and is one of the most far-left attorney generals, if not the most far-left, and he wanted to make a point. And it's not just that case. This article in American Greatness, a magazine I'd frankly never heard of till I read it yesterday because a guy called me up and interviewed me. There are a lot of these cases, and many of them are centered in places like Chicago, San Francisco, and Philadelphia. And you know what these cases have in common, Lars? In each case, the district attorney is a woke DA, because if he's the government or she's the government, if the DA is saying, yeah, I think we ought to give them $10 or $20 million, that's supposed to be the bulwark. The DA is supposed to be the one saying, hold on a minute, let's make sure the public's money doesn't get wasted. When you have ideologues in the DA's office who want to make it look like the cops are all bad and want basically to do a government redistribution of wealth, and some of these, you know, $17, $20, $30 million, I mean, again, anyone who's ever had an insurance claim, as harsh as this may be, knows that insurance companies look, as you say, at what is the earning potential of the individual, what is their age, you know, who relies on them, and that's how those decisions are made. These are not supposed to be versions of Powerball.
No, except that in this case, they get to make political points as well. And the other piece to that, all the cities you named are screaming left-wing liberal cities who chose these DAs knowing, in all cases, what they were and what they represented. And then when they start giving the public's money away to people who in some cases have literally committed murder, not in George Floyd's case, but in other cases have committed murder, and then you decide, and their family deserves to win the lawsuit lottery and get lots and lots of money. Josh, I appreciate the time. That is former District Attorney Josh Marquis, and I'm sure I'll get some pushback from naysayers who will say, well, but they killed the guy. You know what? George Floyd died because of his criminal activity. George Floyd died because of his drug activity. Did a cop do things that were not right? Yes. Did that constitute murder? Did the cop intend to kill him? No. Did the cop do some things he shouldn't have done? Absolutely. And should there be some compensation? Sure. $29 million? You got to be kidding me. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We're live on the Stanford University campus of the Hoover Institution, so don't associate the liberal politics of Stanford University with what we're doing here. We're on the tiny island of conservative thought in the middle of Stanford, but I got a question for you that's very much tied in to technology and questions that are before us right now. There is a bill before the U.S. Congress, and obviously there are a lot of things in the U.S. Congress right now that are drawing our attention, things like attempts to impeach the Secretary of Homeland Security, attempts to impeach Joe Biden, which appear to be going nowhere, even though they should be going somewhere. But there is a bill that I'm concerned about. It is Senate Bill 884. It is known as the Improving Digital Identity Act of 2023. It was actually introduced last year, and it got out of the Homeland Security Committee. And here's the concern I've got. The promise they made, and this was introduced by Kristen Sinema, independent from Arizona, who's leaving the Senate, and Cynthia Lummis, a Republican from Wyoming. And they introduced this bill. And here's what they say. Do you worry about somebody being able to hack your identity? And I think that all of us who are aware of the problem are concerned about that. You're concerned that somebody is going to impersonate you, that they're going to apply for credit in your name, that they may conduct other financial transactions, fraud, in your name. And if you've heard us talk to people on this program in years gone by about how much that can wreck your life, because once somebody has been able to hack your identity and steal your identity, it can ruin your credit for years, for decades. It can literally make trouble for you in some ways for the rest of your life. So along comes the helpful government that says, hey, we've got a great idea. Let's have the government work hand in hand with a private company. Now, I know that there are people who say, well, it'll be one of those really good companies out there. And I say, you mean like Facebook or Google, one of those good kind of companies? But here's what the proposal is in Senate Bill 884, the Improving Digital Identity Act of 2023. They claim that if they establish a digital identity for you, and you have to prove in some way that you are who you say you are, that by doing that, they then basically lock down your identity. And if somebody comes along wanting to impersonate you, apply for credit in your name, you know, sell a house in your name, buy a house in your name, that you'll be able to say no, because my digital identity is locked up tight by this friendly cooperation between the United States government and a private company. Allow me to point out the problems, and if you want to sound off, your calls are always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll or X poll. You can find that at Lars Larson Show. But allow me to point out the problems. I mean, right now, you're supposed to be able to establish who you are, name, date of birth, social security number, and I think all of us who paid attention to this problem understand there are thieves out there who already have copies of all of those things, and probably even some more. They probably know your mother's maiden name and all the other things that they usually use to try to lock up your credit. So that's a problem. And in fact, imagine this circumstance. If they were to pass this as a law, and the U.S. government says, we're going to become the be-all and end-all for digital identity. So once you've established it with us, there is nothing. It'll be carved in stone tablets for you, and nobody will be able to get to your identity. No, what it'll probably mean is that the minute a hacker is able to impersonate you and he steals your digital identity, it would be no different than those people who will move into a house they don't own, create documents that show that they are a legal tenant there, and when the actual owner of the property shows up and says, hey, I own that house, here's the deed, and they say, well, they appear to have a legitimate rental agreement here, and you have to go to court and prove that their rental agreement is not real. How do you prove a negative? That's problem number one. Let me tell you the bigger problem, though, because the minute you establish a digital ID, America can go right down the same route as China has already done. Now, it's easier for the Chi-Com commies, you know, the dictators who run China, Chairman Xi and the rest of that bunch. It's easier for them because they have a social credit score. They say, if you're a citizen and you get involved in political protests that we don't like, all of a sudden your social credit score goes down. And when you try to buy that train ticket, I'm talking about things that have already really happened to Chinese nationals who live in China, you suddenly find out you can't travel. And then you go to the bank and you want to get a loan because your business needs a loan to be able to operate or start. And you say, I'm sorry, your social credit score is too low. The government has decided that you're involved in all kinds of things we don't like. You get speeding tickets. You get jaywalking tickets. You clearly do not, you know, you don't conform to the norms of society. Oh, and by the way, you went to that protest at, it doesn't have to be Tiananmen Square, could be anywhere. You wrote all those op-eds for the paper. In fact, we understand you distribute a newsletter and you put your opinions in it and they don't conform with the opinions of the government. So your social credit score goes down. Once your digital identity is locked in, then the government can do that. And you know who can be their partner in it? That friendly private company that's going to be part of the public-private partnership to establish a digital identity. And you say, well, who are those partners going to be? They could be Elon Musk. They could be Jeff Bezos. They could be Warren Buffett. They could be George Soros. And you don't know who they are or what their agenda is. And we've already seen this happening where you get on social media and then all of a sudden you find your opinions are throttled. I've had it happen to me. I think it's happening right now with our Instagram account where they say, we don't really like the kind of attitudes that you're espousing or the point of view you're espousing. I mean, you're all about small government, limited taxes, maximum individual freedom. You're against abortion, but you're for the death penalty. Yeah, all those things are true. Well, guess what? I'm sorry, but your social credit score is going to suffer. A digital identity is central to that. And I read this great piece, and I'll give credit to him, the investigative reporter Leo Homan. Leo Homan wrote about this. He says these calls for the formation of a public-private partnership to bring this digital system into existence. They say this will all be about national cybersecurity. The only problem is it can go south for individual liberty very, very quickly. The one section of the bill, he points out, is extremely vague about what it says. It creates an interagency task force to find secure, user-friendly, privacy-centric ways in which agencies can serve as the one authoritative, I would say authoritarian, source to validate identity attributes. And you know what? For those of us who actually read a lot of the book, there was a prediction that someday there would be something, you know, you would call it the mark of the beast, but you say at some point there will be people who decide you can't buy something, you can't sell something, you can't earn a living unless you have this. Imagine the day where you go out and apply for a new job. And they say, that's great. We'll put your application in right away. You seem to be perfect for the job. What is your digital identity? Oh, you don't have a digital identity? Well, I'm sorry. We don't consider any applicants who don't have a digital identity. And then you find out it's happening at the bank and your boss and the grocery store. And you've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Would you believe $8 billion of your money is going to be spent by good old Joe Biden for something called a Climate Corps program? And I decided I've got to know what that is because it sounds like a phony baloney government program if there ever was one. So I turned to Daniel Turner, the man who's the president of Power of the Future, to see if we can sort this thing out and find out exactly what it is. How are you doing, Daniel?
Lars, it's great to be on your program. Thanks for having me back.
So what is the Climate Corps, 50,000 government workers to be hired every year by 20 or until 2031? What exactly is it?
No one knows what it is, and that's part of the problem. Our president has always likened himself to a Kennedy. Actually, in fact, he had the whole Kennedy clan at the White House compound yesterday for St. Patrick's Day. He always has that bust of RFK over his shoulder. He is Kennedy obsessed, like a lot of Democrats are. And JFK gave us the Peace Corps. So Biden wants to create something similar. He wants to create the Climate Corps. And this will be it will start with 20,000 people this year, but it will balloon up to 50,000 taxpayer-funded young people who, instead of working abroad to promote world peace like the Peace Corps, they will be working domestically to something climate change. And that's tackling, it. That's all we know about it.
Don't they describe it as tackling? Look, at least for the Peace Corps. I mean, I'm not saying it was necessarily a good or bad program, and I've read lots of things about it over the decades. And there are people who are very proud of their association. But if you said, I'm going into the Peace Corps, and I'm going to go to some terrible country somewhere, think Haiti these days, and you know already what they're going to be doing. If you're a medical type, maybe you'll help people with disease and with injuries. If you're just a hardworking physical person, you go build some housing or build a church or build a clinic or build a school or do things like that. That at least kind of answers itself. What would you do if you were an able-bodied, well-fed, well-educated person sent to a place that's less than desirable? Well, you help them straighten the place out. What does the Climate Corps do? Go door to door and remind people about recycling or what?
Well, that's part of the problem, is we don't know what they're doing. And a huge difference here, and it's a constitutional question, which is why we're hoping that the Congress is able to squash this before it takes form. At least the Peace Corps every year is authorized by the Congress. Its actual inception was a congressional legislation, and every year it is authorized by Congress, and it is beholden to the Congress. The head of the Peace Corps is someone who the president appoints but has to answer to Congress. The Climate Corps is doing none of that. This is Joe Biden just deciding that he has found the resources for 50,000 folks. And the question then becomes, to whom is it accountable? If it's not created by Congress, can any president create this sort of task force? And then you're asking a very important question. What do they do all day? And since Congress didn't appropriate the money, and obviously vis-a-vis Congress, the American people, well, then the president will decide what they do all day. And I guarantee you this, if he's going to have 20,000 of them, he said, by the fall, they, exactly what you said, will be knocking on doors. And they will, of course, they will not say this is part of the election. They will just say, we are raising awareness for climate issues. Oh, and it happens to be an election next week. Do you want me to hand in your ballot for you, ma'am?
Oh, and by the way, since we're not here for a political partisan purpose, but we're here to remind you that there's a president who favors electric vehicles. That's not going so well these days. And then there's this other guy who actually wants us to keep using gasoline-powered cars and isn't as crazy about that, or solar panels or anything else. So you can advocate for the environment, I guess, in that way, and be political at the same time in a way that's somewhat secretive.
Exactly. And this is now taxpayer funded, and that's the problem. I've worked on a lot of campaigns. I've canvassed many times and knocked on thousands of doors, but it was privately funded and it was my own dime. So now we have taxpayer funded 20,000 young people. And exactly as you said, they're going to identify which houses are climate friendly and which houses are not. And what's the firewall to prevent them from handing that data to the campaign? And they will honestly say, look, we're not getting involved in the presidential campaign, but part of raising awareness for climate change is identifying which members, which households are on board. And if we happen to focus on the Philly suburbs, and if we happen to focus on Bucks County, Pennsylvania, right, of course, that's just merely coincidental.
It's well, so and in fact,
the Congress has to kill it.
Well, and here's the thing. At the end of the day, the president isn't allowed under the Constitution to spend one dime without the Congress.
No.
So he put this in his budget proposal, if I'm correct, puts this $8 billion in for a Climate Corps. And I guess that's $8 billion over the next 6 or 8 years. But he's putting this in. That means that if the House of Representatives leaves that item in there, then Joe Biden gets it, but it's not into a program created by the Congress, so Joe Biden controls it, even though the Congress agreed to fund it. Is there any doubt that Republicans would kill this thing?
They have to kill it, and I know they will kill it. The problem is we don't control both chambers, and that's going to be the battle. However, all appropriation has to begin in the House. And
right.
I know the Speaker, having had conversations with members of the House, I know the Speaker has every intention of killing this. But it does make you curious. The President can find $8 billion, and that's remarkable. And just in terms of context, he's only proposing $4 billion additional dollars for the border. But he's proposing $8 billion for the Climate Corps. He's proposing 50,000 people. That's larger than NASA and the EPA combined. I mean, this is a major government entity he wants to create out of thin air.
So, and let me guess that if you're going to go into the Climate Corps like the people who went into the Peace Corps, you're probably going to be relatively young, probably not older. Maybe you're going to come straight out of a college into the Peace Corps, as a lot of people did. And so you're going to be picking from a crop of people that it won't be hard at all. They won't even break a sweat getting mostly liberal, young, true believers in the Democrat Party to populate this thing. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. And, you know, there's an awful lot of poetry majors and modern dance majors who need to do something once they graduate. So this is a perfect place for all of them to land, and we get to foot the bill for it.
You mean, Daniel, that young men and women with degrees in nursing or doctors or engineers are not going to go spend 2 or 3 years working in the Climate Corps for just above minimum wage instead of, you know, put off that six-figure salary and building that future in any of those real professions, that this is going to be the hippy-dippy types who took the major that ended in the word studies? They're the ones who are going to be looking, yeah, $18 sounds good to me.
Exactly. And it's all funded by the taxpayers, and it will lead to political jobs. And this is how he gets to recruit the next generation of climate activists. And the climate activists are the energy of the Democrat Party, right? They're the ones blocking traffic. They're the ones protesting. They're the ones who are knocking on doors. So this is actually a very clever, doesn't necessarily mean it's honest or constitutional or ethical, but it is a very clever way for the president to push his agenda and get someone else to pay for it.
You know, Daniel, I wanted to mention one thing. If this Climate Corps, the Peace Corps, could see anything, you know, the Dominican Republic shares a border with Haiti, and Haiti is a mess. Haiti is full of crime and gangs and cannibalism, and apparently the DR has figured out we don't exactly want any of that. They have built a 12-foot wall topped with razor wire with guard towers and drones and lights and everything else to keep Haiti in Haiti and out of the Dominican Republic. And you kind of wonder, I don't see a lot of Democrats trying to tell the people in the Dominican Republic, oh, by the way, walls don't work. That's Daniel Turner from Power of the Future. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls. We're live at the Stanford University campus at the Hoover Institution, 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting from the campus of Stanford University, but specifically at the Hoover Institution, which sits in its midst, named for a former president from the Pacific Northwest. Herbert Hoover was actually sent out to, I live with, I think, his aunt and uncle, and the school he went to, although he never finished high school, has now become George Fox University. And so it's great to be here at the Hoover Institution. This segment of the show, by the way, from 540training.com. They sponsor this segment. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540. Spell it out. F-I-V-E, 540training.com. Now, before I go to calls, I got to mention this. More than a month ago, when Donald Trump was first found guilty of that fraud case, the fraud where nobody lost any money, there were no victims, and the supposed victims, the banks, said, why, we'd be happy to loan him money again because he always paid back either on time or ahead of time, and we didn't lose a single dime with him. That fraud case, where Trump was told, you put up the better part of $500 million as a bond, or you can't appeal. And I think, you know, people have said, well, Donald Trump's worth $2.7 or $3 billion, and he's got a couple of $100 million in cash or cash equivalent. He should be able to do it. But then the judge said, and I told you this was the key part a month ago, he said, you can't borrow any money from a financial institution that is either based in New York State or does business in New York State. That's basically every bank in the known world. So he has now, his lawyers have now told the judge, we can't come up with the money, which means maybe Letitia James, who had went on a political jihad against Donald Trump, maybe she'll get to go down and seize Trump Tower. Or maybe she'll grab Mar-a-Lago in Florida, and maybe then they'll find out it's not worth $18 million. It's probably worth 30 times that much money. In any case, a little update on that story as well. Glad to get your calls. Oh, and vote in our poll on X. Idaho has moved forward with the Greater Idaho vote. That's where a number of Oregon counties, maybe as many as a third of the counties in Oregon, have said they want to leave the state of Oregon. They want to join in with Greater Idaho. Now the Idaho House of Representatives has voted 41-28 to pass a bill in support of the Greater Idaho movement. Now it's up to those counties, to the state legislature in Oregon, and ultimately to the Congress to decide whether or not they get a chance to do it. To your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Kevin, listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Eugene on KPNW. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Lars.
Yes.
It's considering the issue that you brought up about the person that had went to jail and was exonerated, and he came home and got a bunch of money. Well, the same thing happened to me. I was convicted of an assault in which I was attacked by five people. I'm a veteran. I'm a veteran of special forces. I was attacked by five people. I defended myself, but I was found guilty, and I was sentenced to 15 years in jail. But I got out in
15 years in prison. You can't go to jail for more than 364 days.
Correct.
So you went to prison. You were found guilty by a jury that heard your self-defense argument and didn't believe it?
And didn't believe it. Well, the thing about it was a split. It was a hung jury, but since the majority found me guilty, I was sent to prison anyway.
Now hold on, Kevin. We don't do juries by majority or minority. If one person on the jury says not guilty and the rest say guilty, you do not get a guilty fine. Oh, well. In your days, it could have been a 10-2, but you were convicted of a crime. You went to prison. Then what happened?
And I got out in 4 years because we appealed it, and I won on appeal. And I was sent back to the county that I was convicted of, and I sat in jail for months and months because I wouldn't take their plea bargain. And until I took their plea bargain, that's the only time I was released.
Hold on. You won on appeal, and then you came back and agreed to plead guilty?
No, I didn't agree.
That's what a plea bargain is a guilty plea.
Yes. Yeah, but I told my attorney that I didn't want to plead that. Since I won on appeal, all the witnesses was found, hey, I'm ready to take them on again. You know, but they would not let me out. Every time my court date would come up, they'd push it back further another 2 months. This was in Lane County, Eugene,
okay,
Oregon.
But hold on, Kevin. In almost all cases, when a delay happens in the trial, it's because the defense asks for the delay. Prosecutors don't get delays. I mean, there are very rare cases where a prosecutor walks in and says, Your Honor, the prosecution needs a delay. In most cases, if a judge hears a prosecutor say, we're not ready for trial, he dismisses. So these delays were all asked for by your attorneys, right?
No, sir. The delays were not asked by my attorney because I was ready to go forward with it.
Well, who asked for them?
The prosecutor. They wouldn't let me out. They wouldn't let me out. I sat in Lane County Jail.
Well, if you weren't guilty of the crime, why did you plead guilty of the to the crime?
Because what I understood, that I wouldn't get out, my attorney said, hey, if you're going to sit here and fight them and thinking that you might win, you know, it's a 50-50 chance. And if you do win and you try to sue them, you may not even get the money.
So that means that you agreed to plead guilty to committing the crime. I'm sorry, but that means you're guilty of committing the crime. An innocent man would say, I'll sit here as long as I have to. I never did anything, but you didn't do that. I'm sorry, Kevin, you don't deserve any money.
The Lars Larson. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. This week, broadcasting live from Stanford University.
This university will no longer continue any funding of any kind for your group's activity.
Home to some of the greatest minds of our time. Phil Knight, Hewlett and Packard, the founders of Yahoo, PayPal, and even Lars's mom. Since Lars never graduated college, he's bringing some of the brightest minds on air so he can learn something.
Republicans, are you prepared to go into this fight?
Now, live from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
You can inspire their devotion to American ideals.
Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to be at Hoover. I was telling my audience, I'm talking to Neil Ferguson, who's sitting in front of me, author, the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And you're going to correct me on something, aren't you?
No,
that's right. Senior Faculty Fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. Now, you may have to live that down with my audience, but that's okay. We have kind of a dim view of Harvard these days. Should we?
Well, think of me as a kind of sleeper cell.
you're a mole.
I'm a mole. I'm a mole. I taught at Harvard for 12 years, but I have been... I guess I'm not surprised by what's happened, but depressed. And it's certainly not good for America to have its leading university become a laughingstock, but I'm afraid Harvard brought that upon itself.
Well, they did, and I don't understand for the life of me why they behave this way. Are they pushed by donors? Are they pushed by their board of trustees? Are they pushed by the... They're not pushed by Cambridge, right? They're
well,
maybe.
Let me make this a general statement about elite universities, because I think it's true of all of them. There has been a crisis of governance. Boards of trustees, or in the Harvard case, corporation, have not been effective in their role. And that has allowed a bureaucracy, which has grown like Topsy, to set the agenda, particularly on issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion, the favorite words of such people. And these bureaucracies have played a very, I think, malignant role in pushing the universities into a more and more political, not just liberal, but progressive track. You can blame it on left-leaning faculty, but I don't think they're the key. You could blame it on left or woke students, but I don't think they're the key. The real problem has been this very politicized bureaucracy pushing an agenda that is not what a university's agenda should be. A university's agenda should be the pursuit of truth, should be the pursuit of knowledge and the dissemination of knowledge. It should not be to pursue a political agenda, and it shouldn't be to indoctrinate students.
But Neil, when you say the bureaucracy of the university, or the bureaucracy of government, or the bureaucracy of the corporations that give money to Harvard?
The university bureaucracies are quite a key factor in this. I mean, you can say the federal bureaucracy has played its part, because federal funding has come with strings attached. Title IX, for example.
$600 million a year, yeah.
And that's part of it. And so I would say it's not just university bureaucracies. But my experience of observing Harvard and Stanford, but also going to other universities, is that compared, say, with their British counterparts, American universities have way too many administrators. And if your job is to enforce certain norms about diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's what you do. And the kind of people who take these jobs usually have a very progressive outlook, and I think they have too much power. I think there are too many of them, and I think it's been ultimately very harmful to the universities.
Well, I mean, just today I saw a headline, and I've got to dig into it more, a Harvard medical professor who says he got fired because he stood up and said the lockdowns are not going to work, and they didn't, and they're probably pushed from China, probably through surreptitious means, social media and the rest. And he says, I got relieved of my job because I stood up for something that turned, in the end, he turned out to be right. And a lot of us suspected that the lockdowns were not doing anything about the pandemic and that things would have worked out just as well without them. And he says he got fired. Well, that's the power of...
It's a very interesting case because there were similar clashes at Stanford involving my friends and colleagues Jay Bhattacharya and Scott Atlas,
yep,
who were also skeptical about the lockdowns as a strategy. I wrote a bit about this in the book Doom, which was my most recent book. What's interesting about lockdowns was that they were a Chinese idea that could only really be executed in the People's Republic of China because you need that level of social control that the Chinese Communist Party has to lock people up in their homes for lengths of time. In March of 2020, on both sides of the Atlantic, Democratic governments panicked and decided that they should do something similar to stop the spread of the virus. And this was a mistake for two reasons that were fairly obvious at the time. Number one, democracies just can't lock everybody up. And if they try, they'll fail. And even in the most, as it were, blue and locked, pro-lockdown states such as California, in truth, these lockdowns were not sufficiently tight to stop the virus spreading. So they didn't work in their own terms, and that was predictable. But more importantly, the people who were in favor of lockdowns completely underestimated the unintended costs of locking everybody up and shutting down schools and closing down parks and beaches, and the cost, the social cost, particularly to young people who were not vulnerable to COVID in any meaningful way,
right,
was almost certainly greater than any benefit that came from lockdowns. Now, if you said that in 2020, you got a great deal of pressure from your colleagues, both at Stanford and at Harvard, who felt that you were breaking ranks, but you got real pressure from the federal government, from the public health bureaucracy. That pressure was exerted in very invidious ways through social media. If you wrote these things, they would strangely not get promoted or even allowed on Twitter. And we know that there was a kind of censorship of this argument, the counter-lockdown argument, and an attempt to discredit the people who made that argument. The case in Harvard that you just mentioned, which was written about last week, is a particularly striking case. I don't know the particulars, but it was part of an attempt to shut down debate about whether the lockdowns were the right policy or not. It can't be good in a free society to have that kind of debate shut down.
Well, and not only not good in a free society, but look, I'm 65. I went to college a long time ago, never finished. But I remember that universities at that time used to say, we're an institution of, you know, you come here, you can have an economics professor who's a Marxist, you can have one that's a Milton Friedman, and you can have everything in between. And now it's as though you go to a lockstep kind of institution that says, nope, we all are on the same page, and if you're not, we throw you out.
I think it's clear and measurable that universities have become politically a monoculture. The proportion of professors at somewhere like Harvard who identify as conservative is so tiny now, it's in the low single digits. And if you look at the kind of median professor, they're not just liberal, they're kind of lean progressive. And that's why what gets called wokeism has become so rampant. There's almost no real dissent from the progressive view of the world, whether it's wearing masks or getting vaccinated or complying with lockdowns, just to take the example of COVID. This uniformity of view, I think, is relatively novel. When I was, I'm a tiny bit younger than you, but when I was an undergraduate, Oxford was like that. The Marxists would argue with the far-right professors. It was great fun. And there was no sense that you had to self-censor. In fact, there was a sense at Oxford in the 1980s that you should take risks in what you said, and there would be no downside because you were a student. That's gone. And I think what's interesting is it happened quite quickly.
Neil Ferguson from Hoover and also of Harvard. Can you stick around for a second segment? I would love to have this conversation go on. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls later at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Denied gun purchases. Contact us today at OregonGunLaw.com.
Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'm talking to Neil Ferguson, who's an author most recently of Doom, right? And also the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at Hoover and has an association with Harvard. Before we leave that one altogether, let me ask you about this. How is it that the universities think that it is healthy intellectually to have no dissent on campus?
I'm not sure that they think of it that way. I mean, I think the attitude has become that the purpose of university is not to promote truth or knowledge, but to promote certain social goals, social justice, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And those things are the goal. And if you dissent from those goals, then you should leave the university. You should be run off the campus. I think that progressive mindset has, in a very short space of time, turned the universities from places where you could speak freely and think freely into places where everybody self-censors. I mean, an example is something like 59 or 60% of undergraduates across the U.S., and this is not just in the elite colleges, right across the U.S., say that they self-censor in class. They don't say what they think for fear, not so much of the professors, but of what their contemporaries will think of them. And this self-censorship is a really shocking and relatively recent development. I don't think it was like that 10 years ago. But now everybody is walking on eggshells for fear of saying the wrong thing and dissenting from this new progressive orthodoxy. It's tragic, and it's going to be very hard to change because it's become quickly very institutionally embedded.
Well, and aren't those students going to have a difficult time when they get out in the world?
Not necessarily. Because if they go to Google, they go to certain corporations, the exact same culture exists. And so if you kind of stay in the woke envelope, if you stay in that kind of zone, you won't be challenged, and you won't meet a conservative who could spoil your day by taking the other side of the argument. So no, they may not be challenged.
Well, let me ask you about something else that I planned to talk to you about, and that is American students, college students, who are supposed to be well-educated, are uninformed on the Holocaust?
I think it's a very good question, because I spent part of my career teaching German history. It was really where I began. And the point of teaching modern German history is to answer a very fundamental question. Why did one of the most advanced societies in the world, and Germany led in the sciences in the 1920s, end up producing the Holocaust? Not only producing World War II, but producing an attempt to annihilate the Jews of Europe. And that question preoccupied me from the time I was an undergraduate and motivated me to write a book, War of the World, which was published more than 10 years ago now. That question has motivated me to get out of bed in the morning and go teach students. After October 7th, when we saw the responses on university campuses to the atrocities perpetrated by Hamas against Israelis, I was amazed to find that almost no young people seem to realize the extent to which the Hamas attacks were like a sort of trailer for a second Holocaust. That's what I immediately recognized them as. And that's what Israelis see them as, I think rightly. That seemed to be missing on the Harvard campus, where 30-plus student associations published a statement supportive of Hamas and blaming the atrocities on the Israeli government. And I thought, wow, that's extraordinary. I must have really failed in my teaching if people in that generation react that way. And so I started asking myself, well, are we still teaching the Holocaust? Is that actually there? And it's striking, in many universities, there no longer is a course on the Third Reich. You won't find it. I don't think there is a professor of modern German history teaching that at any of the major universities that I'm familiar with. So part of what's happened is that the teaching of that core question, what on earth went wrong in Germany? How did Hitler come to power? How on earth did the German people go along with anti-Semitism culminating the Holocaust? I don't think that is central to what history departments do anymore. It's been displaced by endless iterations of the evils of colonialism. That evils of colonialism trope gets applied to everything, the United States, and somewhat bizarrely to the history of Israel. So I think in the space of about a decade, history departments have really changed the agenda and made that agenda a distinctly left-wing one, in which everything is somehow a variant on the theme of the wickedness of colonialism.
Even though the Jewish people, I happen to be a Protestant Christian, but the Jewish people could say, we've been, you want to talk about victims of oppression and all that, we're there. And we're a right. Very tiny, tiny group of people who've been kicked out and kicked out and kicked out and finally have this tiny little sliver of land that I don't think most Americans can imagine how tiny
right.
It really is. It's a fraction of most of the states
correct.
In the United States. And you say, and now when people are saying our goal is from the river to the sea, which half the people chanting it don't seem to understand what it means.
Right.
And, you know, that it means wiping out that state.
Yes.
That they say, we're okay with that.
Yeah.
Even though if there were a chant, 70 years ago in Mississippi saying, we will have Mississippi be Mississippi from Biloxi to the Mississippi River, and that you knew it was a phrase that meant something, meant a particular goal to wipe out a group of people, you'd say, well, that's evil. You say, but they don't seem to think it's evil at all.
I think this is a really striking feature of what's happened. The generation gap's enormous. If you ask older Americans, Americans of our generation, it doesn't matter whether they're like us, Protestant Christians, or whether they're Roman Catholics, they have a strong sense of sympathy with the state of Israel and understanding of why a chant of that sort is obnoxious. But young Americans, particularly the very young, I mean, we're talking here about Generation Z, student-age Americans, have a strongly pro-Palestinian outlook and a very anti-Israeli view. Where did that come from? I think it must really be explained in terms of education. The idea, and I've spent a lot of my life studying Jewish history, the idea that the state of Israel is settler colonialism is a truly bizarre one. Not least because the state of Israel was created in reaction to colonialism against British rule of Palestine. So the whole idea that it's a settler colonial project is immediately wrong, and to say nothing of the fact that the Jews have a connection to the Holy Land that is a very ancient one indeed. You can see that in the archaeological remains showing that there were temples long, long ago, and before, of course, the creation of the religion of Islam. So this narrative about Israel is historically completely bogus, but it has been very successfully sold to young Americans. I blame the universities for this partly, but I think social media has played a huge role. If you look at the way in which TikTok pushes anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian videos, you have to conclude that there's something very, very amiss with the role that it's playing. And that is, I think, one of the many arguments for attempting to address through legislation the role that TikTok plays.
See, and I have no problem with what, because I know there are people, and we're going to have to wrap this up in a second, but there are people who frame this First Amendment. I said, it's not First Amendment. I said, Rupert Murdoch had to become an American citizen to own TV stations. Well, why is that? Foreign ownership not allowed. Lots of things that we say, you're a company, you're too big, you have to sell off part of your company. We're
correct.
Saying to the Chinese, 100%. You can't own this thing in America. And they said, well, it's such a crazy idea. And I say, no, it's an idea just like you're not allowed to be a foreign owner. Boeing wouldn't be allowed as a defense contractor.
I made this argument in 2020. I can't believe 2024. We still let TikTok get access to the data and mindset of young Americans.
And ship it right back to Beijing. Crazy. Neil Ferguson from Hoover and Harvard and Stanford, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live at the Stanford University campus at the Hoover Institution, and we're going to be here all week long. I invite your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to talk to Sarah Parshall Perry, who's a legal fellow at the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, about something that's happening in South Carolina that actually addresses a problem that is a problem right now, and I see it as a problem, so-called gender-affirming medical intervention for children, which I'll be blunt about it, as I have been before. I think of more as chemical castration of teenage boys and medical mutilation of teenage girls, but Sarah already knows where I come down on that one. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So would you mind telling my audience about South Carolina state legislation, House Bill 4624, and what it does?
Yeah, so it actually passed out of the House already. It's called Help Not Harm, and we're seeing a lot of the bills like this introduced with exactly that title. That seems to be sort of a popular title now because we're approaching 24 states that have now decided, listen, we have to draw a line and protect vulnerable kids, minors under the age of 18, from being swept up in this craze toward transgenderism and approaching gender clinics seeking hormone blockers, sex hormones, castration, surgeries, voluntary mastectomies. These are big life-changing decisions. And increasing measure, we see state legislators going, listen, we got to stand up and do something. Even if the parents are bamboozled on gender identity, we have a right as state representatives, state legislators, to say, we want to protect vulnerable kids. We are going to limit these procedures and outlaw them for anyone under the age of 18. Perfectly common sense. Like I said, we're almost at 24 states now that have done it. It's passed in South Carolina out of the House. It has moved to the Senate. And this is really an opportunity for the Palmetto State to get things right.
Well, and how is it that tough a decision, given that we're watching Europe right now, which was, I hate to say, ahead of us, but they were farther down the wrong path, and they've now pulled back and said, we're not giving these drugs to any other kids unless they're involved in some kind of clinical trial, and that'll be very limited. And they were doing a lot of this, and now they've backed off completely. How is it that America isn't watching that, saying, we don't want to end up regretting 2 or 3 years from now not doing the same thing they're doing right now, which is hold off on this till somebody becomes an adult?
You know, Lars, it actually brings to mind the horrors of the Tuskegee experiment, right?
Yep.
Where this was an experiment ostensibly under the notion that we were going to assess the rate of syphilis in black men. And so they were instead being treated with lobotomies. And it was absolutely a scandal of epic proportions that generations later, we were still digging out from under. This, to my mind, and I think you might agree, is our generation's Tuskegee experiment. We are, I believe, going to see a reckoning that is going to be catastrophic, and we could potentially stand to lose a generation of young people. These are kids who have no concept of choices in the future as to, for example, becoming pregnant or becoming infertile, and yet what they are subjecting their young bodies to, all in the name of gender-affirming care, is simply a function of an inorganic increase that is trickling down from the White House through the federal executive agencies and into American classrooms, which is why bills like this are so incredibly needed.
So we're talking about a bill that's passed the South Carolina House. It bans so-called gender affirmation medical intervention, meaning puberty blockers, surgery, for anybody under the age of 18, and then says about Medicaid coverage, so government insurance that's supposed to be for people who are poor, not Medicare, but Medicaid, under the age of 26. The thing I can't figure out, Sarah, is this. The longest time I've been a reporter, doctors have worried about true informed consent for anything, anything. And they say, we can't do things without informed consent. How in the world do they think they can get informed consent from a child, number one, a child, but number two, a child who appears to have some visible or detectable mental difficulties? And I'm not trying to be rude. I'm just saying that if somebody says, look, I'm in the wrong kind of body, I'm really a girl, I was born a boy, you've got some mental difficulties, to say it politely, and I'm going to get true informed consent to do life-changing surgery or chemical treatment of that child and call it informed consent, it's like they've thrown it out the window.
Well, and in every other legal context, Lars, you understand that these are individuals who cannot get a tattoo, buy cigarettes, buy alcohol, be drafted, sign a contract. And yet within this context, we, of course, see this rush to affirm only, affirm often. And now, thanks to Michael Schellenberger's incredibly astute reporting and investigation, a leak of documents just a few days ago from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, who has been pushing this as, quote, best practices. These doctors were caught on closed camera in a training session in which the doctors were admitting they were not getting informed consent. And in fact, for these minor children, it was impossible to get informed consent. Well, no surprise. I think many of us who have been screaming that this is a massive conspiracy on gender medical treatment. These are big pharma corporations that are involved, big hospital programs, recipients of federal funding. They are churning out gender-affirming care, again, big air quotes here, in the name of sort of making sure that this is care that they're providing, and actually what has become a craze thanks to the federal government. But at least now we have WPATH admitting in its own words they are wrong and nothing right.
Well, and the just to give people a context for this, 2 years ago, as I recall, this was a $2 billion industry. This year, I'm told it will be $4 billion, soon to be $5 billion a year. With that amount of money, that incentivizes a lot of people to do things, whether it's ethical or not. There is so much money behind it that the medical community apparently can't resist the idea. This is a gold mine. So it's not just that they're doing it for some are surely doing it for ideological reasons, but some of them are doing it because there are tons of dollars tied to this.
Right. Absolutely 100%. In fact, following the money is the greatest answer to this dilemma. Where did the rise in transgender-related medicine come from? Well, back in 2016, there was actually a report out by NBC News in which they were talking then about a boon underway at medical institutions across the country with providing this so-called gender-affirming care. That was all the way back in 2016. We see this snowball effect happening in real time. Most hospital systems are the recipient of federal dollars. And of course, when the federal government is preaching the religion of transgenderism, and you have a man in a dress at the number two post at HHS, naturally, this is an industry that's going to continue to explode unless we see pieces of legislation like this, and we see South Carolina get this bill over the finish line in order to protect a vulnerable kid. If they cannot stop this themselves, and minors, as you know, are so easily influenced. I have three teens. They can't decide what they want to wear or eat, let alone whether or not they're going to be fertile in 10 years after chemical castration.
Very good point. That's Sarah Parshall Perry from the Heritage Foundation. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show, 866-439-5277. And this is the Radio Northwest Network.
work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're broadcasting from the studios of the Hoover Institution on the Stanford campus. And by the way, just a few minutes ago, we got word that the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is crazy, has just extended its ban on Texas from enforcing its immigration law. Now, we've talked about the law quite a bit in the last couple of months, and that is the state of Texas said if the federal government is not going to protect Texas against invasion, we will pass a law and we will have our law enforcement enforce that law. If you come into the United States illegally, that's a federal issue. If you come into Texas illegally, it is both a federal issue and is a violation of state law. The U.S. Supreme Court has just blocked Texas from enforcing that law. Now, I'm going to grab one call before I talk to Don Benton, and I want to get Ron on. Ron, sorry about the long wait. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I'm going to hit everything quick. The reason that we get going back to the situation down in Southern Oregon with the homeless and being enabled, it boils back to Senate Bill 1510 that Janelle Bynum and all these others, including Christine Drazen, voted for this law that took away law enforcement rights to enforce the law. So they get emboldened. Plus, we give them a check. Plus, we give them everything. But you don't address the real cause of drug addiction and everything else. We seem like we're handing out checks. Our budget is ballooned 35% for more federal money, whereas 70% of our budget of $127 billion of the last for 2023-2025 budget, it's not going to help. All we do is enabling and everything else. My suggestion is, all you people, do not vote for Bynum, do not vote for Drazen or anybody else that voted on Bill 1510, and get that bill repealed so that way our people can do the job and be done lawfully.
I think you're absolutely right. Ron, I would agree with you about Christine Drazen. Disappointment there. She wasn't my original pick for governor. I wanted her to win. I would have liked to have seen her won. She didn't win, and she did vote for some things she should not have voted for. And now on that note, let's go to Washington State, and that's Don Benton. Hey, Don, you've got something to tell my audience about the Clark County Convention?
I just wanted to report to you that we had a very successful Clark County Convention, and that kind of closes out the county convention season in Washington State, and all the counties will now be merging in Spokane next month for the state convention. But we elected 100% Trump delegates at the county convention this weekend. It was one of the best run county conventions I've been to in a long, long time. The local party is really, you know, got it together and making things happen. So I was kind of excited about that. It went very smoothly.
And so 100% for Trump, I think that's perfectly appropriate. Can I ask you a question about the primary election, though? And maybe you know the answer. I haven't been able to get the answer. Why, when I sign my ballot, because I vote in Washington State, so does Tina, why do I have to put my signature and my party affiliation on that outside envelope for anybody who wants to see?
It has to do with the law that was written some time ago and an agreement between the two major parties many years back. I'm not an expert on it, but it's up to the parties to decide nationally who their nominee is, and that has been respected, which is why they do that every 4 years only on a presidential primary, and it doesn't happen in any of our other primaries in this state, whether they're partisan or not. It's unique to the federal law in terms of choosing the nominee. And I'm not sure why. I've talked to a constitutional scholar on that.
What's the benefit? What is the benefit to the process of me declaring? I don't mind. I do it on the radio all the time. I'm a conservative Republican second, but I'm a Republican. But a lot of people don't like the idea. I'm putting my signature and I have to publicly identify myself as a Republican, but I'm putting it on my ballot. And what happens when my ballot marked Republican on the outside just somehow doesn't make its way through the mails to the elections headquarters?
A couple of problems with that. Number one, I agree with that. That's worrisome. However, it's incumbent upon every voter to verify that their ballot has made it, because we are forced to use the mail-in system in Washington State.
But
we have no choice.
Don, I agree with you that you should check and see that your vote actually was counted. But what happens when you check and you say, they didn't count my vote, but it's 5 days after the election? What good does it do you?
Well, none other than exposing some problem or issue with which we all know exists with the mail-in system. And we should go back to in-person voting, in my opinion.
I agree.
When you're out of town, when you're traveling. When I first started voting, it was you had to apply for an absentee ballot when you were going to be on business on election day out of state.
Agreed.
And you had to send in and sign a thing that said so. And, those ballots were treated very carefully. Now, everything, they come in through the mail. They come in, they're printed out over the internet. They mail them in postcards. It's pretty astonishing when you see what passes for a ballot and what they actually will count these days. So it's kind of scary. We really need to go back to a system that has a better control on who has cast that ballot.
Well, do you remember when there was a presidential... There was a presidential commission on voting, and it was headed up by the estimable James Earl Carter. But still, he said the commission decided, after looking at America's election system, the greatest opportunities for fraud came in vote by mail. And we should have listened to the results of that commission, and we did.
There's no question about that.
No, I want to find out if there is no benefit to signing the outside and putting your signature out there and your party affiliation, they should take it off the envelope. Thank you, Don. I appreciate it. That's Don Benton, and you've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.